So what I'm going to do, like Flick said, I'm going to talk around some of those cultural differences which are often invisible to us, where white English people from one background doesn't realise they are culturally so different from another. But before I get to that, I couldn't not let Denise say some stuff, and I'm sure she'll be praying for people afterwards because she's half good at that. But I thought it'd be good for Denise to talk. Well, I don't even know what you're going to say, but you're going to say some nice things, aren't you?
Yeah, I'll just tell you a little bit about. I'll tell you a little bit about the background I come from. Okay, I didn't come from a Christian family, and the family I come from, my mum never did anything nice. And you know, I love my mum, but I'm just going to say it as it is. Can everyone hear me? Sorry. And my mum never really said anything nice to me. She would criticise me, but she never said anything nice. And she never made me feel that I would be good at anything. She would always say, oh, you won't be good at anything, you know. And so you grow up with that, and you carry that with you. So as you grow up, you think, well, I'm not going to amount to much. And that's how I always felt. And I had lots of fears and insecurities. And so it would sort of limit me to what I could do. And I think, oh, I couldn't do that, I'd be too scared, or I wouldn't do this, or that would be out of my comfort zone. But then one day I become a Christian and God just changed everything. God gets hold of broken people, and that's who he loves using. Damn, he doesn't pick perfect people to go and do his jobs, he picks broken people because he knows that they will know where people are coming from. So even the other day, my mum and dad come round at Easter and we was having dinner and we was talking about not everyone's good at this or not everyone's good at that. We all have things that we're better at. And then my mum, in front of everyone sitting around the table, said, well, what are you good at? And it was like being a kid again. And I thought, oh. But then I thought, no, brush it off. Jesus has changed you. And when we went to bed that night, I said, Paul, did you hear my mum? He said, yeah, I heard it. And we just prayed, Jesus, we you know, take that away. It's lies. It's just lies. And, I feel like she most probably didn't have lots of compliments or encouragement. So that's why she's like she is. But I'll just quickly say this, yeah, then I'll let Paul talk. But God uses damaged, broken people. So I work in a local primary school, and being quite a sensitive person, it's a great place to work because there's so many damaged children. It's an inner city, like working class school, but now the area's changing, so there's a few posh kids in there now. So we've got the Aries and the Charlies, but we've also got Xanthes and Caspians now. So, but anyway, kids are kids, and God loves kids. So I work in this school, and one of the stories I wanted to share with you was there was one particular class who was so, they just didn't get on. And the head teacher kept saying, I don't know what we're going to do with that class. She kept going in there to try and sort them out, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so one day I was thinking about the class and they just had this really bad press all the time. So I said to one of the teachers, how about if somebody went in there every morning and maybe did a little prayer and told them every day is a new day? And so she's told the head teacher came and found me and said, would you start tomorrow? And I was thinking, I didn't mean me, I meant somebody, not me. But I had to go and do it. And then lots of the staff at my school aren't Christians. And so they saw me in this class every morning praying for this class. Everyone was thinking, what are you doing in there? You know, who do you think you are? But I kept doing it every day. And then I started calling some of the children out and said, why don't you come and pray for your friends? Come and pray with me. So a few kids put their hands up to come and pray. So they started praying for their friends. And then it used to be every hand went up and wanted to come and pray. So you'd only pick a few because it was only going to be quick and then they could move on. And then that went from that to the head teacher had heard how lovely these kids started praying and learning to pray, that every assembly now she will say, would anybody like to come and pray for the whole school? All the hands go up from reception up to year six. Kids put their hands up. These little children, they don't know what they're going to say. Now, that's daunting for adults, but children do it. And it was a simple throwaway comment like, Why doesn't someone go in and pray for them in the morning? And God uses them things. So don't ever discount yourself that maybe I'm not altogether, God can't use me. If he can use me, I tell you, he can use anybody, honestly. And yeah, it's just one story just to encourage you that God can use you, okay?
Go on, yeah. I'll just put this microphone back. So, Denise could have told you loads of stories from the influence she's had on that primary school. So that the kids, she initiated a kids' lunchtime prayer meeting every Thursday. And at one time, there was, I don't know, it was about 15% of the school. It's only one class intake, so it's a small school. 15% of the school are coming just to pray in their lunch break. They rushed their lunch. One Thursday, she wasn't there. In fact, we was away somewhere together, weren't we? One Thursday, she weren't there, and the kids turned up at the room as usual, and one of the other staff members said, actually, Denise ain't here, so you can't pray today. So they gathered in the corner of the playground and just prayed. I mean, just mind-blowing. This is the stuff you read in books of revival when you know, don't you? This is... So it's small, but it's significant. One little girl prayed. She brought a prayer request to that prayer meeting. Just her dad's got he runs a pub restaurant locally. He owns it, and he'd had some staff problems, and he'd lost a lot of staff, and he needed essentially a reliable, competent person. And his daughter was in the prayer meeting saying, please pray for my dad because he's working long hours, he's cooking, he's cleaning, he's serving beer and he needs someone else. So the kids prayed for a man to come and work in this business. That day, somebody applied for the job and got it. And the mum and the dad were overwhelmed when the daughter said, well, we prayed that today. And it's little primary kids, just knocking on heaven's door and impacting the kingdom of God. It's fantastic, ain't it? Brilliant. I'm not going to expound scriptures today. I will tell a few more stories and also talk about some observations I've made all around that subject, thorny subject in lots of ways, of class and the culture of class in our nation and what is dominant and what isn't. And just for a bit of context, just recently I had the privilege of taking a small team from our church over to the Ukraine to do an outreach week, to go and tell some people about Jesus. We landed in Kiev and then we spent a day in the city. It was the same time as Eurovision, which was, everyone thought I was going to Eurovision. I wasn't, believe me. And then after a day in Kiev, we drove out to a very remote rural village, very poor, where there was one known believer, one known evangelical lady who wept when we arrived, and we spent the time telling people about Jesus. Now, I could tell you stories about that. I will just to say that we left, we reckon about 10 to 15 believers in that village, which is great. But what I want to tell you is, before we went, we were speaking with the person we know over there and who gave us lots of insight into the local culture. And we lapped it up because we wanted to know how best to communicate, how best to connect with people, the do's and don'ts. So, for example, I mean, I quite like a pint every now and again, but we were told, under no circumstances, we're not drinking alcohol. Over 40% of Russian/Ukrainian men are alcoholics. I mean, drinking vodka, it's a huge epidemic problem over there. So the Christians don't drink. So that's a small cultural thing. I think there's nothing wrong with having a quiet pint with your mates. I know that. But culturally, I needed to be aware of that. And really, that's just to illustrate where we're going to be going with some of the stuff this evening. Is that all right? Okay. So that's a yes. That's a thumbs up. A bit of my story. I grew up surrounded by diesel lorries and piles of building materials because my family ran a builder's merchants. In fact, it was a demolition and a haulage business, and then latterly a builder's merchants. My dad was a lorry driver in the family business. My grandfather started it. My dad and my uncle and my brother all worked for that business for a good number of years. And we lived adjacent to the big builder's yard, right? So there's a dozen lorries going. When I was a little kid, there's 12 or so tipper lorries starting up and driving out every morning. You know, it was dusty in the summer and it was muddy in the winter. So just to set a bit of scene of my background, I left school at the age of 16, which was the same year my mum walked out on us, me and four other siblings, which obviously has an impact on your life, don't it? Essentially, the impact it had on me is not to trust people and not to open up to people, and particularly not to trust women. That was just to be a very closed person. After I left school at 16, I drifted into a couple of sort of office junior type jobs, because I went to grammar school, so you had to do sort of that you were sent down a certain route, right? So I thought, oh yeah, trainee office manager, it was my first job. What a load of nonsense that was. But eventually and probably inevitably, I ended up in the building trade. So my family ran a builder's merchants. Like I said, my maternal grandfather and uncles on that side were all bricklayers and builders. And most, if not all, of my friends were in the building trade. So it was inevitable, after a couple of years, I ended up working as a hod carrier on building sites. You don't even get them nowadays, I don't think, because of health and safety. And then latterly as a bricklayer. And I loved that life. You know, I enjoyed it. I'd never set foot inside a church until I was 25 years old. None of my family were Christians. No one talked about God or Jesus or church or nothing like that. And then, one day, the girl I was living with said to me, I'm going to church in the morning. That was Denise, by the way. Listen, this was the most bizarre. I thought she'd gone mental. I thought she'd gone mad. She said, I'm going to church. And she did. She went the next day. This was on a January Saturday night. She went off to church. She came back a different person. Now, and she was lovely anyway, and she's even lovelier now. It's all sweet. I'm happy, right? And then she started on me, right? You must come to this church. You must come and meet these people. They're lovely people and all of that. You know, she'd say things like, you just about put your head on the pillow overnight. I don't want you to go to hell. You think, blimey. I didn't want me to go to hell either. I didn't particularly know what the school was, but it doesn't sound nice, does it? Because it had turned out, Denise had a real fear of death and dying, and this become a massive controlling thing in her life. And I used to say really comforting things, oh, love, we've all got to die, don't worry about it. But so, and then she found a little tract that was given out on the street. Do you know when you walk past people on the street and they're giving out bits of paper and you just take it, and she just took it and put it in her handbag and didn't even look at it. Nearly a year later, she was looking for something else, a bit of makeup or something probably, found this leaflet and thought, that's the answer. And she went off to church. Now, that's the backstory. So then she started on me. I've gone along, and it was the weirdest experience of my life. All that singing stuff, I thought, I don't understand this. And then the preaching, whoosh, you think, I don't get it. And I wasn't going to go again. And then this other fellow who knew, was another big Welsh bricklayer, knew I was a bricklayer, and he invited me to come back again the following week because he was preaching. So I thought, oh, I'm too kind and polite to say no. So I thought, oh, I'll come again next week. It was even weirder because this big shovel-handed Welshman got to the front to preach from the book of Jonah. I still remember it 30-odd years later. And started weeping. I mean, not just silent tears. He was sobbing. It didn't impress me, let me tell you. I thought, this is just weird. But there was something about this church and those Christian people and God at work that hooked me. And I think it was the people being so nice, you know. And this is an encouragement to you because you've been nice to us this week. Continue to be lovely to people. But these nice people hooked me enough for me to say to myself, I don't know anything about Jesus, so I'm going to find out. And I started asking and reading and looking into things, and I thought I'd have some really good questions, and I'll throw these questions at people, think I'll get you now, and then, oh no, that's a good answer. And then you read a bit more about Jesus, and this process took me a few months, about 3 months, and then I got to a point of thinking, if this stuff about Jesus is real, and I believe it is, then I've got to do something about it. And one night in the dark, on my own, I prayed, Jesus, please forgive me for the things I've done wrong. And I named some of those things to him. I won't tell you what they were. And then I said, Jesus, I'm going to follow you for the rest of my life. And I meant it. And that was the massive change, obviously, in my life. I didn't realise how massive it was going to be. It wasn't long before we were involved in planting a church down on the sort of Thames estuary, south bank of the Thames, in a place called Gravesend. We then moved up to central London to be part of an existing church in Bermondsey. Right, I mean, we live walking distance from where that latest terror attack was. We would go down there regularly. That's the sort of part of London we're in. And we've been involved in the church there for 23 years. I went to be on staff of that church. We've been telling people about Jesus and getting immersed into the culture and the community ever since. And it's like we've just started, honestly. And we've got to know loads of different people, loads of different communities, different aspects of society, different schools, people in the council. I'm a secretary of a local amateur boxing club. I got to know all the local boxers there. Just different. All my boys are all in their 20s now. I know all their mates. There's some naughty boys there, but they come to us when they've got issues in their life, and they come to us and they're interested in Jesus. It's fascinating, and it's rewarding what God is doing in us. So I've been in Bermondsey a number of years, and really went there. God prophesied, spoke prophetically, and we moved there. And a few years ago, I was fortunate enough to be offered a sabbatical, 3 months sabbatical or study leave, and I took some time out to study the relationship between the church and the working classes. It was something that intrigued me. It's something that had challenged me. When we first got saved, the church was very posh, weren't it? I mean, we were like a novelty act, honestly. We probably still are in some places. They couldn't quite connect with us, but they did their really best. They were lovely, but we just weren't on the same level as them. So I could tell you loads of funny stories on that. I mean, even being invited round to someone's house for dinner. You know, that's what we do as Christians, isn't it? Oh, come round, you must come round for some dinner. Maybe you don't, I don't know. Well, when somebody said, oh, you must come round for dinner, I thought, what are you on about? I don't go to people's houses for dinner. I ate my mum's food. I went to me nan's occasionally for dinner, and one of my aunts, who was a rubbish cook anyway. And honestly, at that age, at 25 years old, I think that was it. I'd not eaten in anybody else's home, you know, sat round a dinner table as a dinner party type thing. So this was the weirdest thing. So that straight away, there's a cultural difference that I experienced. Now, that may not be your experience, but just to be aware of those things. If he'd said, come and have a pint, I would have felt much more at ease, or even meet me down the calf. But to come round someone's house and sit round a dinner table, just too weird for me, right? But you're wrestling with those things, and you want to be nice, and you're learning to be a Christian and all that, and you're hungry to hear things. So I sort of overrode those, but it was painful at times. Can you think of anything else from those days? I put you on the spot. You didn't know I was going to do that, did you?
I think I'm just talking about different stories about your background.
Oh, your family.
Yeah, you know, my dad used to smoke. When he finished, he sounds disgusting, but this is how it was. He put his cigarette out sometimes in the
gravy. In the gravy on his dinner. He's finished his dinner.
My...
And all these nice, polite, posh people, they're just so different. Anyway, loads of differences. But on the surface, you seem the same. That's the point of all of this, really. So I did this sabbatical, and it was really based on one thing that really triggered it for me. We're a very culturally diverse church. We're in the centre of London, so there's people from all over the world. and all levels and stratas of society in our church. We've got an MP who's a member of the church. He's a Tory, but I forgive him. He just about got in this last lot with a massively reduced majority. But so we got an MP there, but we've got people, you know, who are almost rough sleeping alcoholics. They've got flats, but they don't really live in them. You know the sort of person, very dysfunctional. And lots of people in between. There's scaffolders and builders and, you know, school teachers and head teachers and the whole. Plus people from West Africa and East Africa and South Africa and people from all over Europe, you know, the whole bit. That's just London, isn't it? And we did this thing to look at culture, to understand culture. And we were sat around tables, and we are with different people from different nations answering questions like, what was family holidays like for you? Tell us about meal times in your house. You know, mundane lifestyle type questions. And as we talked, I thought, and I noticed, the biggest difference, the biggest cultural difference was not between, say, the person from Ghana and the person from the Philippines, but it was the white working class people there were the most different, if you like. And it just struck me, I thought, we don't even talk about this, we didn't then. And it challenged me, and I started to look into those issues, and I had this 3 months off, and look at it into the context of local church. And when I was investigating this, I met some fascinating people, right? I've met barristers and bank robbers, you know, church leaders, church members, union activists, international economists, homeless alcoholics. But everyone had an opinion. You pushed them, and everyone had an opinion and an experience about class. And particularly those from a more what we would call working class background, they were very aware of class prejudice. People dismissed them because of their perceived lack of formal education. People dismissed them because of what job they did or didn't do, right? And you think, that ain't right and that ain't fair. And it just stirred me to look into the whole subject. Have you heard of Martin Lloyd-Jones? Anyone here who's been a Christian for a little while? Martin Lloyd-Jones was a very well-known Christian. He died in the 80s, but a prolific sermonizer, and loads of his sermons are in book form. But he made this quote in the 70s. This is back in the 70s. And let me read this to you. He said, "The impression has gained currency that to be a Christian, and more especially an evangelical, means that we are traditionalists. I believe that this largely accounts for our failure in this country to make contact with the so-called working classes. Christianity in this country has become a middle-class movement." This is back in the 70s. "Far too often, as non-conformist men have got on in the world and made money and become managers and owners, they have become opponents of the working class who were agitating for their rights." So he's highlighted a difference. He's highlighted a separation. And, you know, that gulf is still there. A couple of years ago, I was invited by the Evangelical Alliance. They have these council meetings where they invite people in, and they have a sort of discussion forum and talks given for a day, entitled Class, Society and the Church. It's still being wrestled with at the sort of higher echelons of evangelicalism. I don't know why they invited me, but they got me there. And if people are wrestling with it at that level, even in a small church in Bromsgrove, I'm sure you're wrestling with the same issues. Because it's all across the country. And we've got to learn, and we've got to learn from one another. I just want to highlight a few things where I've noticed differences where people often don't see the differences, right? Just, you know, that cultural difference which may just help us when we're chatting to one another. And it may just validate your feelings of frustration if you see yourself on one side of this discussion. So one of the things I noticed when I chatted to people during that sabbatical time, that 3 months, was people's attitudes to education. Now, I've got 5 kids. None of them have got a degree. None of them have got any student debt either, which is nice. They're all working. They've all but the oldest have got kids. I've got 12 grandchildren. So has Denise, funnily enough. My oldest boy has actually done a university, done a sort of postgraduate thing. He's a musician and he did a thing on jazz drumming and composition, very out there. But the rest of them, one of them's a scaffolder, one of them's a firefighter, one of them works in an architectural reclaim business, right? So my attitude to education, I've reflected on this, was I didn't really push them to go to university. Maybe I should have done, I didn't, right? So they've gone down a certain route. So you could argue they've got much more working class jobs. That wasn't intentional, that was just instinctive, I think, almost. But everyone wants their kids to do well at school, don't they? The difference is, middle class people generally have the skills, the necessary skill set and resources and confidence to take initiative in the education of their children. You know, when you're dealing with schools and, you know, I know loads of people, I was the same myself. You go to a school to talk to the head teacher and suddenly you're a little kid again and you're talking to a head teacher. You think, it shouldn't be like that, should it? I've trained myself now, I'm different now. You know, middle-class parents instinctively tend to instinctively prepare their kids for formal education, right, even before they get to school. And a system is geared for that. So the system is predominantly middle-class in its style and its the way people learn and communicate. Whereas I've seen working-class kids learn totally different skills, particularly preschool, skills which don't prepare them for formal education. So from the outset, they're often playing catch-up. So, you know, little kids, I've seen some little tiny kids have learnt to ride a two-wheel bike, right? You think, there's a lot of skill involved in that, isn't there? Maybe you think, oh, it's just riding a bike. Little tiny tots, 18 months old, flying around on a two-wheel bike, right? Little 4- and 5-year-olds who can confidently hold a conversation with an adult. They can banter, they know the subtleties of communication. But so they're often coming across as mouthy kids with a teacher, but because they're intelligent and they're able, but they haven't learnt the right skills to go on in formal education. Now, I've generalised and I've just thrown out a couple of illustrations there, but I think if we're aware of differences, then we're equipped and we're a little bit more understanding. I mean, the whole thing of communication was a massive one. Right, when I was asking some people, so middle-class people are two-faced, was what a lady said to me once when I asked her, what do you think of middle-class people? Right. Now, that's not true. No more two-faced than anyone else. But I know, I understand what she meant, right, because I've observed it, and I'll illustrate this from experience. Right, so I know some trustees of a local youth club, right? One of them is really... He's posh. He's like upper middle class, I would say. Ex-retired army officer, gentleman, upright, polite, smart. The other guy is a working class fella. They're both in their 60s, both the same age, both involved in this youth club, and you couldn't meet two more different people. And so when they communicate, I mean, this is funny, because the conversations between the two of them have been like comedy, if it wasn't so sad, really. So the working class fella was always brutally honest, right? That was a high value for him. If he thought it, he would say it, right? And it can be quite insulting sometimes. You think, you don't say that. But for him, that was a high value. Honesty was a high value. So if he thought something about you, yeah, you're just a snake, you are, you're too, or whatever, he would say it. Whereas this other guy was much more measured and much more careful with what he said in case he offended people, right? So he's very polite. The working class fella just thought he was two-faced because he didn't say what he thought. So you've got two people of from the same nation, the same age, but totally different backgrounds, clashing, upsetting one another, often offending one another, because the middle class man was perceived to be a liar and two-faced because he didn't say what he thought, and the working class man was dismissed as being downright rude, right? We've got to understand how to communicate with people. I had to understand how to communicate when I went to the Ukraine. You know, even through an interpreter. Even my body language. I was told off, not nastily, I was told off by one of the pastors there. When I was praying for some people, we were praying for a couple of builders actually on the street. I said, can we pray for you? I'll get my friend from London to pray. Because I didn't clasp my hands in front of me and bow my head when I prayed for these guys, he said that they won't even think you're praying. I had to learn a different way of behaving to communicate more effectively. Now, I could have said, well, that's how I pray. I've always done it like that. You know, I kept my eyes open, I looked at them, and he said, well, don't. If you want to connect, then don't do that. And it's the same thing. If we understand there's differences of communication, we'll be hearing with different ears, won't we? What about a sense of place? This is something I think is so strong in certain areas, certainly around our area. You see that? Did you see that fella on the news who attacked the three terrorists? He's a Millwall fan, right? Millwall's our local football team. So he saw them. They're shouting, chanting for Allah. One of them's got an Arsenal football shirt on. Big mistake. So he said something along the lines of, they're shouting, oh, we're for Allah. He said, F you, I'm Millwall. And he attacked the three of them with his bare hands. I mean, if you saw him on the news, he's got cut up about five or six times. But that comes from a sense of place. And I see it in our area. I don't know whether it's so strong in other areas. I suspect it is in certain working class areas. So there's an identity, a communal identity. So it's like he could have just said, we're Bermondsey. And I've heard that said. And so he's identifying with a sense of place. And people do that. And maybe you've experienced that. Maybe you grew up on a certain estate or around a certain industry. You know, Bermondsey was a strong docking. There's loads of dockers there. The Surrey Docks was a big, massive employer and all the associated industries, right? Similarly in the East End with the East India Docks and all the rest of them, the Royal Docks as well. So strong insular local identity, which is a corporate thing, whereas in middle class culture the individual is championed, isn't it? Get on, you go and get a good education. Why? So you can get a good job. Why? So you can earn a lot of money. You achieve often at the expense of others, right? It's very different in working class communities where there's a corporate sharing and a sense of we're in this together. I'll look at that in just a moment when I talk about money, right? So a sense of place. Now, just to be aware of that, so if you're moving into an area to plant a church or to be part of a church, understand that often you'll be perceived to be a real outsider, even if you're the same colour. Right? Often students move into the slightly poorer areas of a town because, for obvious reasons, it's cheaper. Right? So you've got these young, posh white middle class kids in a rougher area, and you think, oh, why aren't I connected? I'm a Christian, I want to serve them. You've got to understand you're seen as no different than, I don't know, the Somalian community have moved in and took over a load of houses. You're seen with suspicion and you're seen as someone who's not on their side, even though you are. So there's cultural barriers to break down. So a sense of place, and that really ties in with a solidarity. You know, that sort of working class solidarity, which you may think is old-fashioned and gone. It's still around. It may come out in a slightly different ways. You know, when we moved in to Bermondsey, and we're outsiders, right? And culturally, there's a lot of similarities. My family moved from Deptford, which is very close. It's just down the just along a little bit. Denise is from Greenwich, which is just a little bit further along. Very, very close. But we moved, our families moved out and we moved back in. So, you know, I can communicate and chat to people. I've been there 20 odd years. I've immersed myself in the area. And then people say, oh, what school did you go to? And you think, oh, I don't go to school round here. There's just that little gap. But we've essentially connected and we're part of the community. And I asked one of the ladies in our church about preaching, because I think that's another thing, how we communicate the gospel, right? And she said, oh, I like it when you preach. And I thought, she likes my use of illustration and application, which connects with her. And she said, because you're one of us. It's very interesting, isn't it? She liked me preaching because I'm sure my illustrations were good and my application was even better. But that was on the top of her head, because you're one of us. She identified common experience as one of the bonds that holds us together. It's an instinctive solidarity. You know, and you hear people say, oh, he's all right, he's one of your own. And that can cover over a multitude of sins. Because he's one of you, you can forgive him for quite a lot of things much easier than if he's an outsider, he gets the blame for everything. But churches could tap into that solidarity. You know, if you've got a small group like that, midweek group, where you've got that instinctive solidarity, it'd be fantastic, because there are people that bring friends. Come to this church, come to the... I'm racing through this, but things about, like our churches, right, our church meetings. I think it's worth reviewing church meetings, right? Churches, sometimes it's so much like school. And you know, the middle class values of education, it's like we go as church and we sit in quiet rows taking notes when the preacher's speaking. You think, is there going to be an exam at the end of this? And we say church is like family, don't we? And yet, you know, some families are not like we see in church, right? There's kids running around and there's kids shouting and people are shouting across to others, you know. And in church, we all sat in rows and we all be quiet. We've got to understand what we're saying and what our definitions of these things are, aren't we? To understand and connect with one another. So our meetings, it's worth reviewing. I'm not saying you should change, but understand why you do things and what you do. You know, the words of the songs we sing even. If we're thinking about people coming amongst us, we need to understand it. How we preach and what we preach. Now, that's much more, obviously, it's not for everybody, but it is for us as we communicate. If we're speaking to our friends and neighbours about Jesus, you know, be aware of what illustrations you're using. You know, to say, you know, to illustrate something about God providing money, saying, well, when I was at university, I really didn't handle my money well, and my father had to increase my allowance, doesn't always connect with people. Just to be aware of that, isn't it? You know? We need a close relationship between our evangelism, our outreach, and our social action. They need to be entwined and they need to be connected, and we need to honour people. We need to honour people, whatever their background and whatever job they do. I don't know if you've found that out. I even heard somebody preaching once, I'm paraphrasing it, but he basically said, there's nothing wrong with being a street cleaner. He said, but I wouldn't want my son to do that. I think, how rude is that? What you've just said there, you've just demeaned loads of people, right, who do a valuable job. Isn't it interesting that the lower paid jobs, if they stop doing it, they're the ones you notice. If people weren't cleaning the streets, mate, in a couple of days, you'd notice it. Right? The management consultant, if he stopped doing his job, no one would ever notice it, actually. And he's the one who's earning hundreds of thousands a year. Right? We should value people for who they are and what they do, whatever it is. We need to be accessible. You know, the urban areas of the UK, the estates and those so-called difficult communities constitute a classic mission field. No one goes to them, or very few. It's not no one, but very few go there. There's been a complete loss of the gospel story across loads of the white working class communities in this nation, and we need to realise it, and realise it quickly. And then we need missionaries to go. And I know people in this room are doing that very thing. We need to go to what is often seen as alien, hostile territory. It's like, oh, I'd rather go to Iraq to preach the gospel and go to the estate down the road. You think, what are you talking about? Right? You know, we're willing to work out strategies and understand cultural differences for countries like the Ukraine, for example. But we don't even consider the estate down the road. I don't want to go there. I heard a church leader say to me once, he said, we don't go to that part of the town because of the chavs. I ain't kidding. I won't tell you what church. It wasn't around here. A church leader, and he didn't say that with any sense of irony or even, he just said it. Well, we don't really go to that part of town. You think? Oh, great. So we won't take the gospel to those people. That was, yeah. Anyway. There's a challenge for us. We need to recognise and honour working class culture, change our attitudes towards them. I mean, the whole thing I mentioned about finances, didn't I? Attitudes to money. Massive. Right? Generally speaking, and I'm a bit like this still, right? If you've got money, you can spend it. Right? It's nice to have a bit of money. And you can be generous with it. Right? It's only money. Share it out. Working class people are much more... I'm generalising. Would put their hand in their pocket. Middle class people, they might be generous, but in a different way, because they're often thinking of the rainy day. So I know somebody. I spoke to one girl who told me, and genuinely, she told me, she said, I haven't got any money left at the end of this month. And I thought, well, you have, because you told me how much you had in savings. So, but she didn't even equate the savings she had with her need, the immediate need today. So it's just an understanding. So one family I know, some had a girl, a travelling hairdresser, right? The travelling hairdresser came around, did the whole family. I forget the price, but say it was £95. I don't know how much it was, right? And they said to the girl, they gave her £100 and said to her, oh, we haven't got the exact money. You can give us the fiver back on Sunday. Right? No, you ain't bothered about that. That really shocked me. I thought, how tight is that? But then when I found out who it was, I think, I know how much they give to the local church. So it's not that they're tight. They were perceived to be tight, though. So it's just that attitude to money. You know, she'll give you her last tenner, that woman. And I've known people do that, literally, because somebody's had a need, and they've gone, oh, well, I've got this, you can have that. But those people are in the same church often, and it's just an understanding and getting our heads around the whole attitude to money, because there'll be misunderstanding, like those two people. There was a misunderstanding. I used to work in the family builders merchants when I was at school. You know, school holidays, my grandfather said, come on, get out and load that lorry, and we'd go out. And I'd look on the ticket where we were delivering the materials. And if it was one of the posh houses in Chislehurst or Bromley or something, that was the posh areas near us, I'd think, 13-year-old kid, I'm going to be carrying all these bricks and cement around the back of their house and he won't even give me a look, right? You go to the modest council house and you took one bag of cement round the back for the fella and you go, here, boy, they'll give you a fiver or something like that. Can you see the difference? It's just understanding difference. I'm not saying one's right or one's wrong, although when you're a kid, you think you want to go to the bloke who's going to give you money. That these are differences that we need to be aware of, and we need to honour people. Let's honour one another, whatever their background, whatever their job, whatever they've done. Let's not just say, oh, isn't it great that we've got a member of parliament in our church? He's really very unassuming, actually, this fella. So I'm not having a go at him. But we don't champion people because of what they do. So formal education, if somebody's got their PhD, we tend to lift them a bit higher than everybody else. Wow, he is so bright. You think, why is he any better than the guy who is sweeping the street, for example? He isn't. And we can honour those people equally. As Christians who've chosen by God before the foundation of the earth. We need to strategically reach out. 5 minutes. Thank you. Because I'd love to pray for us. We need to strategically reach out and plant churches in working class areas, because we've run out of university towns to go and plant churches in. Our family of churches, that tended to be the strategy. There's a church with a university, so there'll be loads of students there, so let's go there and we'll take some people like us with us, and then we'll reach people like we used to be when we were a bit younger, and we build a church. And I'm not saying it's wrong, because everyone needs the gospel, but it stays and it reinforces a middle class culture. And suddenly middle class values get woven into church values, and we could do another whole seminar on that. What is Christian and what is middle class? Because the dominant culture in church is middle class, and therefore their cultures get woven in with Christian values, and people justify their actions from the Bible. And you think, hold on, that's not necessarily right. So let's go to places where people are different. We go to the Ukraine and do it. Let's go to the estate down the road. We need to raise up working class leaders. Right, for a long time, I think our church is genuinely diverse, right? And I'm not boasting. The foundation of our church, C.H. Spurgeon planted our church 151 years ago with the express stated reason to reach the workers of Bermondsey. It was a poor area. No one wanted to live there then. I ain't kidding. It was rough as you like. And right up to the early 90s, it was the same. Rough, tough, insular. Spurgeon planted the church there. So the foundation of our church was to reach working class people, but also to raise up working class leaders. I think, oh, I'm one of them. Took me a long while to realise that. You know, my background is not one of formal education. Is my job was as a builder, bricklayer, was, I suppose, more traditionally working class. But the problem is, we look for anointing, yes, but we also look for academic ability. And there's a challenge for us and for some in here. And whoever you're raising up, we should all be mentoring and discipling people to come through. Don't just look for the person who's got a fistful of A-levels and a degree, right? You know, we tend to train in the classroom. But I think the model of the bricklayer is a good example. As in the model of the apprentice is a much better example. I used to watch, you know, even as an odd carrier, I put their bricks and their mortar down for them, and you'd watch and you learn by watching people, and then you might get a little go yourself, and then you go and do a bit in college, and you think, oh yeah, and you're learning and you're watching and you're experiencing and you're sharing, and suddenly you're getting the hang of it. It's not I'm not sitting in a classroom watching videos and listening to lectures of how to be a bricklayer. I'm experiencing it. Does that make a sense? We can train and equip leaders at all levels in that way. Don't overlook unschooled, ordinary men, the Word of God says in Acts chapter 4. And if we do that, do you know the passage where Peter and the other apostles, they might be considered unschooled, ordinary men? Because if we do that, if we miss them, we'll be missing some mighty men and women of God. You know, I was reading about, I've only got, how many long? 1 minute. I'll tell you one story. I was going to tell you about D.L. Moody, a famous preacher from America who had come from a very poor background. Let me tell you about a fellow called Elijah Cadman. Elijah Cadman was born in Coventry. It's not too far from here, is it? Not too far from where you guys are. He was the youngest of five children of a drunkard father who died when Cadman was 3 years old. At six, Cadman was unusually small, and because of his size, he was a chimney sweep's boy. The cliche is he was sent up. They were sent up chimneys. That's exactly right. He would climb up chimneys to clean them. He was often drunk from the age of 6 years old. By the time he was 17, he had the reputation that he could fight like a devil and drink like a fish. That was his reputation, right? Age 21, he became a Christian through the Salvation Army. Right? And after his conversion, he spent all his spare time preaching. Because he couldn't read or write, This ex-chimney sweep boy couldn't even read or write. He used to hire a boy to read the Bible to him, and he'd commit large sections to memory. Right? He subsequently did learn to read and write as an adult. And he later joined William Booth's, what was the Christian Mission before it was even the Salvation Army, and he became one of William Booth's right-hand men. Right? And people were still scared of him because he was a renowned prize fighter. So whenever there was any trouble, he would just roll up his sleeves and walk slowly down the aisle and they'd all calm down. That's not your typical preacher, is it? But a mighty man of God. The point is this, when Christianity really changes the culture, it gets hold of the working class. Some people say, go to the top, go to the elite, go to the media, go to the politicians and the bankers and the arts and the media people. I don't agree with that. Oh, God save them. But to change a culture, we need to go to the working class, to the masses, if you like. That way, we'll see transformation come. The 18th century Methodists, before them, the ordinary people of Britain were rejected, literally rejected by the church. Churches had little, some of them old church buildings had, they'd let the working class in, but they wouldn't let them in the pews. They'd have little rooms up high where they could hear the preacher and they couldn't be seen. I've been in old churches and seen these rooms where, so they could, they'd allow them to listen to the gospel. That's nice of them, isn't it? But wouldn't share community or life with them. And then the Methodists came along and they proclaimed the gospel to those guys. They went to the poorest and became friends with royalty. Similarly with the Salvation Army. They went to the roughest and the toughest, and at William Booth's funeral, the queen of the day was there. My time's up, so I'm going to leave you with three questions and then we're going to pray. Three questions. What do you see as the main barriers to reaching working class communities where you are? How are you going to overcome those barriers? And what will becoming all things to all men mean to you? That's from scripture, which I cut out because I've run out of time. But that's the apostle said, to be all things to all men. What does that mean for you? So there's some challenging questions. I hope I've scratched a little bit where you're itching, because this is a massive thing for this nation. Otherwise the church will stay predominantly middle class in its culture. And I know there's a multitude of exceptions we can point at, but the dominant culture is what we're looking at. And that needs to change. That needs to flex. Should we pray a little bit? Is that all right? Let's stand together. You've sat very, very well.